Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York, and we begin today, as we have done so many times, too many times on this show, with a crisis that is uniquely ours, uniquely American. Today, our country witnessed the 129th mass shooting of this year alone. This one, like so many these days, took place at a school. Three young students and three school staff members were killed today. They were killed at Covenant School. That's a private school in Nashville, Tennessee. After a shooter walked in and opened fire. After law enforcement engaged with the suspect, the shooter was killed, according to law enforcement. The shooter was a 28-year-old woman. At this hour, not much more is known about a potential motive, but it is worth noting, at least at the top here, how rare this specific situation is involving the shooter. According to the Secret Service, there were only five female shooters out of 173 attacks from 2016 to 2020. In Washington, D.C., President Joe Biden has been made aware of the shooting, calling it sick and heartbreaking in brief remarks. But we're going to turn our attention back to the community affected today, back to Nashville. In Nashville, families will be grieving for the six people who just went off to work and school today and tragically lost their lives. And as a country, we must collectively continue to ask the question, when and how does this ever stop? Does it ever stop? The anger and frustration of Americans was best summed up today by a woman named Ashby Beasley. She happens to be a survivor of the shooting in Highland Park. Do you remember that one? It took place in Illinois on the 4th of July last year. Seven people were killed and 50 more were wounded. She was on vacation just a few blocks from where the school shooting took place today. She heard shots fired and ran to the scene. Watch.
Aren't you guys tired of covering this? Aren't you guys tired of being here and having to cover all of these mass shootings? I'm from Highland Park, Illinois. My son and I survived a mass shooting over the summer. I am in Tennessee on a family vacation with my son, visiting my sister-in-law. I have been lobbying in D.C. since we survived a mass shooting in July. I have met with over 130 lawmakers. How is this still happening? How are our children still dying, and why are we failing them? We can't even pass gun safe storage laws in this country to protect kids from getting a hold of weapons that they shoot each other with. Aren't you guys tired of this? Are you guys sick of it? We have to do something. We all have to call our lawmakers, and we all have to make our lawmakers make change now, or this is going to keep happening, and it's going to be your kid and your kid and your kid and your kid next, because it's just a matter of time.
That is peak 2023. After surviving a mass shooting in her hometown, she went on spring break with her son and witnessed another. Joining our coverage, Clint Watts, former consultant to the FBI's counterterrorism division, now a distinguished research fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute. Also joining us, our friend Dave Cullen. He's been writing about mass shootings in our country for years. His latest New York Times bestseller is Parkland, Birth of a Movement. Our friend, the former Senator Claire McCaskill, is back with us. But we start with Tennessee State Senator Heidi Campbell. She just met with the families of the students of Covenant School today. Senator, what can you tell us about how the families are doing?
Hi, I just spent the past 5 hours in a waiting room that nobody should ever have to be in, the worst waiting room I've ever been in, just watching families who were waiting to find out what had happened with their children, and saw one woman find out that she'd lost her child, and the primal scream that came from her was just unbearable. This is insane. Our gun culture is out of control. And for those who think it's not about the guns, I'll just point out that you can't have gun violence without guns.
Senator, is there anything that people watching can do to support your community today?
We don't need thoughts and prayers. We need common sense gun reform. This is ridiculous. I really appreciated the comments that I just watched from Ashby, who was just coming through our town and had to once again experience a horrific shooting. And we need common sense gun reform, and we need it yesterday.
The stupidity of the sort of response from from expanding access to guns usually take shape in the earliest hours. I'll just sort of cliff note it. Well, you need more good guys with guns to deal with bad guys or gals with guns. Do you have any understanding of the circumstances today? And do you have any understanding of why this school and these very young children were targeted?
I don't know the details of that, but I don't think it's good to focus on the details of that, because inevitably what we have are people that shouldn't have guns in situations where they shouldn't be using guns, killing people that shouldn't be killed. And so, you know, once again, I'm sure that we'll go through the details of this and talk about mental illness. And mental illness is a huge problem in our country and something that we have to address. But this is an issue that is about gun violence, because these kids would not be dead if there had not been a gun involved.
Our friend and a regular on our show, Shannon Watts, tweeted this out today, and it caught our attention. This is the Tennessee member of Congress who represents Nashville. His name is Congressman Andy Ogles. He's a Republican. This was his family Christmas card. It feels like the district is represented by someone who isn't just an advocate for access to guns, but almost fetishizes them. What is it like for that community to be represented by someone like that today?
Having spent most of the past year running for Congress against Andy Ogles, I can corroborate that that he is somebody who very much supports our gun culture in Tennessee. Look, you know, it gets framed as an issue about freedom, but I can just tell you right now that it's not about freedom when you're dealing with parents who don't have the freedom to know that their kids are going to be safe.
I remember being on the air when Uvalde happened. I called on some of the same friends who are standing by to cover today's tragic school shooting at Covenant. And I asked a lot of elected officials about all the kids who, starting at 3, prepare for mass shootings at their schools. And the active shooter drills change as you go from 3 and 4, where you're hiding from a bad guy, to 5 and 6, where you have a little more sense that it could be someone with a weapon, to 7 and 8, when you're helping other classmates and you're being moved into closets by teachers, to 9, 10, and 11, when you hang onto your phone so you can send those texts that become imprinted in every mom and dad's brains that are sometimes the last messages from their children. What is it like to be a kid in Tennessee right now and train for an active shooting that maybe feels a lot more real after the shooting at Covenant?
The parents in that room were trying to figure out how they were going to talk to their other children and their surviving children about what they had been through. And the situation that you just described is just so sad. It's just so unfortunate that our kids are kind of growing up in this culture of terror.
What do you want people watching to keep in mind as the community takes months and years to heal from what happened today?
I want people to actually put their energy into making sure that their elected officials are committed to common sense gun reform. That's the only thing that is going to change this. You know, I'm not against the Second Amendment, but we can certainly do something about the fact that that the wrong people are getting a hold of guns. There are all kinds of options for that. And I really want people to stop praying and giving people their thoughts and prayers and actually do something about it.
I want to add to our conversation some of our other friends. Dave Cullen, we're going to have to get you some specialty in natural disasters or, I don't know, maybe bank fallout, so that we don't have to call you so often when there's a mass shooting, and especially when the target is a school. Yeah. But I wonder what goes through your mind when this familiar headline flashes across all of our phones.
Sometimes I don't know how to feel. This has been a bad week because a lot of people probably didn't even hear there was just a shooting in Denver a few days ago at East High School, which was three blocks from where I lived in Denver for 10 years. I've been in that school many times. I wrote big chunks of the book Columbine at the tattered cover bookstore across the street. And I can't tell you. I have like personal connection to about like five mass shootings now. And I wonder how many people are left in America who have not. And I agree with Senator Campbell, and I thank God for Ashley Beasley. It's going to come to people like them. And the one thing recently that I took heart from is the people still doing the work. Is a couple weeks ago, earlier this month, I was asked to be the keynote speaker for the National PTA's annual Capitol Hill sort of lobbying effort. And I was a little taken aback that they wanted me to do it. They wanted to focus on guns this year because of all the issues. I felt like, you know, with this House of Representatives, it's not going to happen, this Congress. Right. But I was actually so impressed the more I thought about it, because they're not taking 2 years off. They're going to keep working, changing some minds. The NRA doesn't take 2 years off when the Democrats got both houses of Congress and the White House. They are still in the trenches working. They're probably changing some minds slowly for the next chance, when hopefully in 2 years it will be in different hands again and we can pass the next law. Shannon Watts, who you just referred to, and Gabby Giffords, 10 years ago after Sandy Hook, they had nothing. It seemed impossible. Remember, that's when people were saying this is the end of, you know, gun safety. We called it gun control then. The bleakest moment, impossible. They had no chance of winning anything. They just did it anyway. And they spent most of their early years in the state houses, state legislatures, where they lost and lost and lost. But they started learning how to win. And they started getting smarter, and they started gradually winning. And now in the state legislatures, they're winning most of the battles. Because they kept showing up when it seems impossible. And it, to me, that's the only thing we need to keep asking America to do, and moms and people out there who have given up the faith, is it can happen. The hopelessness is self-fulfilling prophecy. You have to go out there and do it, and eventually we can knock this down. But it takes a bunch of people like Shannon and Gabby and Ashley and Senator Campbell just doing it anyway.
I mean, Dave, I hear you, but you know, the public has risen to the moment. 85% of the public supports a policy that has no chance of passing. 90% of the public supports bans on bump stocks. 85% supports universal background checks. A majority of gun owners support all the gun safety storage, and nobody thinks anything. I mean, how do you bridge the gap between, I think Shannon and Gabby, and I mean, they've done their work. They've persuaded the public to do something. But what is entrenched is the political lock that the NRA has on the Republican Party and Republicans, for better or worse, to win elections. How do you solve for that?
Totally. Well, we saw the strategy that will work last summer when we peeled off, what was it, like they needed like eight senators, Republican senators, and got 18, something like that, including Mitch McConnell. But right. We heard from Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia and Jody Ernst, who ran initially on that famous, you know, gun ad, the last people in the world, people from Texas, who switched because they said the calls coming to their office were 6-1 or 10-1. Republicans in gun states were telling them, you have to do something. You have to do this. When Republicans' own voters are starting to turn on them, which is finally happening, that's, I think, the inflection point. So we got one, but that seemed impossible a year or two ago. And, you know, the research I did on the polling before that, the main pollster for both Moms Demand Action, Giffords, told me before that she picked up something in the polling the last previous year or two, was that people were starting to see Congress as the bad guys. Mm-hmm. People who, including all these people, the 85% who wanted these things, felt like it's the NRA stopping it. The NRA is the bad guy doing this. they started feeling like, well, the NRA isn't in Congress. It's also our people in Congress. That's a recent change. And that's why somebody like Shelley Moore Capito, who would have never would have voted for something like this, did, because she came back and said, wow, the political winds have shifted. Mitch McConnell went to his caucus after they did a poll to show support for it and said, even among gun owners, it's overwhelming. He warned them, we're going to lose the suburbs if we don't start doing something on guns, and then personally voted for it. That was unthinkable. So that's the road to victory, is continuing to peel off those people. And frankly, we need Republican voters. We need conservative voters in gun states. They are the key to this, to put the most pressure on their senators and Congress people.
Claire, I'd love your thoughts as a former senator on everything Dave's saying about the politics shifting just in the last 12 to 24 months, as well as a mom and a grandma today.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you can win in red states, in purple states, advocating gun safety. NRA came after me in every single election. And yes, I was defeated in my last election, but I won a lot of elections going toe-to-toe with the NRA. The second thing is, Nicole, run on guns in the suburbs. Run on guns. Run on military-style weaponry, slaughtering our children sitting in classrooms. And, you know, we like to talk about the culture wars of the Republicans. They want to go after drag shows. Well, we want to go after high capacity magazines that are designed for only one purpose, to kill as many people on a battlefield as possible in as short a period of time as possible. We have no reason allowing anyone to buy high capacity magazines without, frankly, at all. They should be banned along with these assault style weapons. So run on guns, especially in suburban areas. I think there has been a fear for so long in purple to red states that you can't talk about guns, that you can't run on that. This is our culture issue. This is our issue. That and women's reproductive freedom. 2024 ought to be the year that the Democrats run on guns.
Amen. Clint, I want to bring you in on this, and I want to just come back to Nashville, Tennessee, and show you what one resident thought was happening as this unfolded today.
I thought maybe it was a bomb threat. And then there were so many police cars, and then the ambulances started coming away from the school. And that's when I had heard it was a school shooting, and there's no words.
There are no words, Clint, but every week in America, a couple times a week, as Dave accurately points out, we have to come up with the words. And we start this show trying to find the words to describe how this is how we decide to live. That somewhere in our country, just about every week, drop-off is the last time you see your third or fourth or fifth or second grader.
Nicole, it's a remarkable transition over the last 20 years that we went from worrying about a foreign terrorist group attacking a monument or a capital, trying to do some dramatic overseas terrorist act, to most of our concerns now are about somebody in our local community showing up with a gun at a school or a workplace or even a grocery store and committing mass violence. So the threat picture, as we would say, has changed dramatically. And when you look at it, the two factors involved in this, it's the frequency and it's the impact of each of these attacks. Just looking at the frequency of these, this is far greater in scale than anything we've seen in any period of American history in terms of number of these attacks that occur. And when we start to look at why, it is a range of factors. Some of these are tied to some sort of ideological motivation, but many are not. Many are grievances that individuals hold against other people, and that comes down to the impact. Why don't we see this in other countries? Other countries don't have assault rifles delivered directly to the hands of a shooter at nearly a moment's notice with no curbs on them. And so when you put those two things together, we can point to social media, we can point to ideologies, but the reason so many individuals die every day in this country due to gun violence is because of the access to weapons. The same weapon that I was given 30 years ago for the first time, we carried around without any ammunition in it. Just think about that. Now, anyone can go access that weapon, gain ammunition to it in almost an instant, depending on where they are in this country, and they can use it against any target that they choose. So the entire landscape has changed so dramatically. And to think that we would continue to let this go, there's lots of things we can do to reduce the impact, particularly with regards to assault weapons and access to weapons. That could be training, it could be licensing, it could be insurance, it could be red flag laws in terms of identifying people that we think are at risk. And then in terms of the frequency, which is how did we become a country where so many people, particularly young people, but people of all different types, as we learned today, have a proclivity to violence. Why are we killing our own citizens in this country? And I think that takes a much broader examination to see how we can get much more out in front of this. We would never have tolerated this from Al-Qaeda or ISIS supporters 10, 20 years ago, but we tolerate it every day in many other circumstances.
I mean, Clinton, as you're talking about the threat from Al-Qaeda and foreign terrorism, I remember back to what felt like a statement of unity when people wore American flags in the months and years after September 11th, and some still do. But there's a prominent and vocal group of Republicans. I want to get their names right, especially today. Congressman George Santos, Congresswoman Anna Paulina Luna, and Congressman Andrew Clyde, who, instead of wearing any other pin, wore a picture of an AR-15 on all their lapels. So where a flag might have once sat in the months and years after September 11th, or for a normal person whose salary is paid by the United States taxpayer, a pin with a replica of an AR-15 sits on their lapels. What does that do in terms of the culture and the fetishizing and the celebration and the demand for an AR-15 style weapon, Clint?
Yeah, it's a strange militarization of our culture. And I always remember back to, I think, General McChrystal, commenting at one point, being one of the first people out there very vocally saying weapons of war don't need to be on our streets. I think it's just a bigger issue of what on earth are these weapons for? When I learned for the very first time how to use a weapon, it was not a semi-automatic machine gun. It was not something that had extended magazines with a large clip. It wasn't something that had a bump stock on it. These are weapons of war. And then it also just begs the question of where would this ever stop in terms of the escalation of weaponry that are provided to people with no training, no certification, no licensing, no responsibility for these weapons. It is a weird sort of fetish around these weapons. And why would we continue to endorse and condone that in our own country when we see the damage that is done by these weapons, particularly to one group above all others, children? We've seen this consistently go all the way back to Newtown and to today. You see that these weapons tend to show up where we have mass casualty events. And who are the people that are killed? It is minorities. It is groups of faith. It is children in their schools. It is a bizarre sort of sacrifice that we've chosen to make in this country to have just this one weapon so that everyone can have it at a quick access. There's no reason for it whatsoever.
Senator Kemp, I want to give you the last word. I want to follow up on something Clint said. I mean, before today, 56 children from newborn to 11 had died so far this year in 2023. It's not even April in mass shootings. Tragically, we can add three to those numbers, so they rise to 59. And I'm not sure if you saw this yet, but here's what Dr. Jill Biden, the First Lady, had to say to your community today.
We just learned about another shooting in Tennessee, a school shooting. And I am truly without words. And our children deserve better. And we stand, all of us, we stand with Nashville in prayer.
Senator Campbell, I know that's not the solution, but I think that is where a lot of people who are doing the work as well to change our policies and to change the people who hold elected office, I think that's where a lot of people's hearts are today. And if there's anything else that you want to say on behalf of the families whose lives changed forever, long after we're starting our broadcast with this story. They will be absent one of their children forever. And if there's anything else you want to say on behalf of those families, I want to give you the last word.
Thank you. And thanks to the vice, the first lady for her words. I was just with these families and I knew before they knew that they were about to find out that their child was gone from them forever. And yes, of course, this is a time when we have to support these families who have just lost their child. It's insane and it shouldn't be happening. And so for today and for the next few days, let's support them. But like your other wonderful guests have said after that, let's get to work and start to actually enact some common sense gun reform. It's far past time. And I run bills every year to address this. And we spend more time worrying about how drag shows might be hurting our children than about these sorts of events.
Indeed, we do. This is who we are. Senator Heidi Campbell, thank you so much for starting us off. Clint Watts, thank you. And Dave Cullen, always a privilege to talk to you. Thank you. Claire sticks around. When we come back, we'll turn to the news out of the grand jury that is investigating the twice impeached ex-president in New York. They reportedly heard from a new witness as Trump and his allies in the Republican Party step up their attacks and threats on Manhattan's district attorney, Alvin Bragg. And later in the program, the ex-president's glorification of the Capitol insurrection in, of all places, Waco, Texas, 30 years after a deadly siege that became a rallying cry for domestic extremists, including some of Trump's closest advisors. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere today.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
My question to you, would potentially violence be justifiable? Was January 6th justifiable?
Well, I will say this. No, I don't like violence, and I'm not for violence at all. But a lot of people are upset, and, you know, they rigged an election, they stole an election, they spied on my campaign. They did many bad things. They did a fake dossier. Mueller was bad news.
So where do you see this going from here?
I have no idea what's going to happen, but I can tell you that they have no case. So I think the case is, I think they've already dropped the case.
This is your update from Earth 4, where the delusional twice impeached ex-president hangs out. That was, as you said, delusional thinking on his part, because if the Stormy Daniels hush money case had been dropped, why did the grand jury conduct a new interview just a couple hours ago this afternoon? Late last hour, NBC News confirmed it was one David Pecker. It's his name. He's the former CEO of American Media. He is the publisher, or the former publisher, National Enquirer. He was interviewed by this grand jury today, and that would make it his second appearance in front of this grand jury. Based on this late-breaking development alone, clearly, whether the twice-impeached ex-president likes it or not, the work of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg continues. And as the American people prepare for a possible indictment, it appears the majority of them agree that the investigations are all above board and necessary. A brand-new poll released today by NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist reveals that 56% of all Americans believe the investigations into the ex-president, all of them, including DOJ's examination of January 6th, are fair. Just 41% are witch hunt. Where would they have heard that? Joining us here at the table, legal analyst Katie Fang, host of MSNBC's The Katie Fang Show. Also joining us, New York Times reporter Katie Benner is back. It's so nice to see you. Plus, Tim Miller is here, former RNC spokesman, now writer at large from The Bulwark. Katie and Tim are MSNBC contributors. Claire is still with us. Katie Fang, let me start with you. Tell us what you think is going on. We're still reading tea leaves. I mean, this is sure. The secret process. But what does it mean? Remind everyone who David Pecker is one of the most riveting characters in this season of the Trump follies, if you will. Why would he have been there today?
So David Pecker was the former publisher of the National Enquirer. His name and Dylan Howard, who was the editor of the Enquirer, they were heavily involved in the negotiations with Stormy Daniels and her then lawyer, Keith Davidson, for this hush money payment. What's interesting is that this is the second time that David Pecker has appeared in front of this grand jury. And more importantly, David Pecker and Dylan Howard insisted that Michael Cohen deal in the negotiations. They themselves didn't do the negotiations. They dispatched Michael Cohen to do so. And in fact, from what we know, Michael Cohen was pressured by Dylan Howard as well as David Pecker to hurry up and get this deal done. Why? Because Donald Trump wanted the deal done. And so to have him appear twice, some people may get concerned. If you are really wanting a prosecution of Donald Trump, you might say, did the grand jury really need to hear again from David Pecker? And the answer is yes. And the reason why is we did have Robert Costello appear last week, who tried to take down Michael Cohen's credibility when he appeared in front of the grand jury. And so there's the dotting of the I's, the crossing of the T's. But what's happening now is it's pretty much when you have to go back and watch season one of a show and you want to get back to the current season of a show, that's what's happening. You're seeing a lot of the same players show up, but we should expect an indictment shortly.
Katie Benner, what's interesting to me when you listen to the twice impeached ex-president do whatever it is he's doing and laying the foundation for violence, or talking about, on the one hand, he doesn't like it when his own track record suggests he's very enthusiastic about violence specifically and generally, as well as the findings of his own Justice Department when Bill Barr ran it. SDNY found that Donald Trump, quote, coordinated and, quote, directed hush money payments through Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels when he was president. So really all that Bragg is doing is matching an investigation already done and dusted by SDNY when Trump was president. Is there really any dispute on the facts, or is this still largely a political operation?
I think for the investigators, it's whether or not they can use the evidence that they have to bring this case to a jury and get a conviction. I don't think that there's a lot of people really arguing about the facts. It's just whether or not they can show that the facts amount to a crime. Now, when you talk about what Donald Trump has done here, you know, for him, this is always political. And he's a master of using investigations to his advantage. Now, what makes this one different is if it ends in an indictment, this will be a campaign upending historic moment. And so it will be really interesting to see whether or not he can continue to use something like that to his advantage. It's one thing to be investigated and to say this is a witch hunt and to say there's nothing there. It's another thing to be faced with the prospect of a grand jury that has said, no, we actually think that the preponderance of evidence is powerful enough that this should go forward and that a jury should, a jury of Donald Trump's peers should look at this and decide whether or not he should go to jail.
You know, I mean, Katie, what is the, I went back and read all Michael Cohen's, the sentencing memo, and in Jeffrey Berman's book, he writes about how involved Maine DOJ was, and just the use of Donald Trump's name. He was described as individual one and all those documents, but he's an unindicted named conspirator in a hush money scheme that was viewed as a violation of federal law. Is that ever introduced in this case, or are they totally separate?
Well, the evidence is not mutually exclusive. If you have admissions or statements that are made by witnesses, by parties, they can be used. Sometimes they face an evidentiary challenge in terms of it being hearsay. But the admissibility is independently determined when you're actually looking at each case. I think what's important in this particular instance is, as Katie Benner has noted, you do have a federal case that's different than the state case. But there was a lot of criticism of Alvin Bragg. And, you know, we talk a lot about prosecutorial discretion and the ability to exercise your judgment as a prosecutor. That is exactly what Alvin Bragg has done and continues to do. He faced an insurmountable amount of criticism previously because he would not actually do what Cyrus Vance also didn't do, which is do the Letitia James asset inflation prosecution, etc. We know that Mark Pomerantz had a lot of criticism about whether or not there was going to be an ultimate prosecution of Donald Trump. So Bragg is not trying to race across the finish line in this instance. If that were the case, I think you would have seen an indictment by now. But the fact that you see David Pecker appearing again today signifies that the grand jury is hearing kind of some solidifying the testimony and the evidence that they already have. But again, you can use that evidence that was in that federal case, and everybody points to that, specifically Donald Trump, excuse me, not everybody. Trump points to that to say, look, I was exonerated in some way, but he's wrong because Michael Cohen went to federal prison for it. And he's the only person who's done any time relating to this particular hush payment scandal.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Alvin Bragg is the tallest peak here, Katie Benner. I wonder if you have any understanding of what happened at DOJ after SDNY found Donald Trump to have, quote, directed and coordinated a hush money scheme that benefited his candidacy, a federal crime. I mean, John Edwards did, I think the evidence was softer and it ended John Edwards' career. I mean, what is the final disposition of what the Merrick Garland Justice Department had to say about the crimes as described and ascribed to individual one?
Well, I would say, first of all, keeping in mind before the Merrick Garland Justice Department, there was the Bill Barr Justice Department. And so even though that's how Donald Trump was described, we know that that department, top to bottom, believed that you could not indict a sitting president. So even though that's how he was described, there was never going to be an indictment of him for that activity. And then you move on to what we see here. It is really everything related to Donald Trump has now been given over to a special counsel. It's not clear that that was ever really revived. It seems to have withered and died on the vine and has become, you know, the focus of local prosecutors in New York. It's to be seen. I would be really surprised to see if Jack Smith has decided to look into this or to probe this at all. It seems that they really want to just go forward with the two big issues, one being January 6th and whether or not the former president had a role there that could be prosecuted. And then, of course, his treatment of documents and whether or not he was investigating the federal investigation into retrieving those papers.
Claire, I'm sure Katie Benner is absolutely correct, but that in and of itself is a political decision. Crimes were committed, crimes were described, and they were ascribed to Donald J. Trump while he was president. And we all know now, thanks to Robert S. Mueller, that a sitting president can't be indicted. There was that OLC memo that guided all of the decisions. But nonetheless, you know, Trump didn't have the sex with Stormy Daniels, allegedly, and his campaign, I mean, Michael Cohen didn't benefit from the act. He didn't participate in it. So, you know, this missing piece and all this targeting and all of this threatening of Alvin Bragg is in some ways created by the vacuum of the body that investigated all the conduct, that examined all. I mean, before Hope Hicks and Kellyanne Conway were into Alvin Bragg's grand jury, I believe they were interrogated or questioned by the federal government in which they served. And I know it didn't lead to an indictment, but it certainly is a corroborating set of evidence and conclusions. What do you make of the fact that nothing was ever done there?
Well, there's a chasm that occurred when Donald Trump left office before the special prosecutor was appointed. And I know Merrick Garland kind of hides behind the veil of, well, he wasn't a declared candidate yet, and that's why I appointed a special prosecutor. But it wasn't like all of this wasn't predictable from the moment that Merrick Garland became attorney general. I can understand there nothing happening at the federal system until he was confirmed. But once he was confirmed, it's hard to not really get busy and look at all of the facts that were screaming from the mountaintops about what this guy did, from paying off porn stars to obstructing investigations to trying to control the Justice Department to trying to overturn an election to try to put forward fake electors to try to call a Secretary of State and fabricate votes. I mean, all of these facts were swirling for month after month after month. So I will never have a good explanation why the federal government sat on its hands for as long as it did. But make no mistake about it. If Congress continues, if the Republican clown show in Congress continues to try to impede local prosecutors doing their job, it could have huge ramifications to the rule of law in this country. And that maybe is what most concerns me the most right now, is the fooling around that McCarthy and Jordan and Comer and all these guys are doing with trying to mess with the what has been sacred sovereign power of a local prosecutor to enforce state law.
Yeah, and listen, I'm not going to dignify it by playing it, but Comer was on CNN. And Tim, I just want to get you in on this. I just don't want any conversations about what Alvin Bragg may or may not be doing to ever be separated from the investigation that was conducted by Bill Barr's Justice Department that concluded that Donald Trump directed and coordinated a hush money scheme that benefited his own campaign. Bill Barr's DOJ, SDNY specifically, found Donald Trump to have committed campaign finance violations. So if Alvin Bragg matches that evidence and brings an indictment, he will be the second prosecutor to do so, not the first.
I love how much of a dog on a bone you are on this point, Nicole, because it is the key point, right? It's that Donald Trump was the person of interest here. He was the person that did the crime initially. He was the person that the crime benefited, that Michael Cohen went to prison for. I think that it's true both in the Bragg case and it's true in all of the January 6th cases that Claire was just discussing, right? I think that there's this righteous frustration that a lot of us have. The idea that, you know, there have been other people that are being held accountable, lower level people, both in the Stormy Daniels case and in the panoply of January 6th and insurrection cases, for the crimes that only happened because of Donald Trump. Had Donald Trump never had sex with Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen wouldn't have gone to jail. Had Donald Trump not tried to steal the election, there wouldn't have been people storming the Capitol on January 6th. It was Donald Trump who was the criminal across all of these instances, and all these guys that are trying to muddy the waters and change the focus from this are just trying to make that fact less crystal clear.
And we don't ever live in a vacuum where Trump supporters who are willing to storm the Capitol, who were willing to chant "Hang Mike Pence" to a degree that at least Mike Pence thought they were serious. I mean, I've never seen anyone run down those stairs as quickly as he and his family did, and I'm glad they did. But there are now hideous things out there targeting Alvin Bragg. And all Alvin Bragg did was conduct an investigation after SDNY, after Cy Vance, after Mark Pomerantz, matching their conclusions. And I think that there is this dissonance between what Trump likes to say. He likes to target Democrats, but his own DOJ found the same crimes to have been committed by him. We have to sneak in a break. I need all of you to stick around. There's much more to get to, because when it's Trump and it's investigations, it's never ending. Don't go anywhere.
Does he have an obligation to denounce the rhetoric and what has happened to to Alvin Bragg? We had a prayer rally for Alvin Bragg this morning. This man and his family could be under serious threat.
What someone sent to Alvin Bragg has nothing to do with Donald Trump.
How do you know that?
Because Donald Trump would have nothing to do with that.
Donald Trump wrote death and destruction indicted.
However,
he announced that he was going to be indicted Tuesday. Mm-hmm.
That came from leaks.
He posed with a bat.
No, he didn't. No. So let me explain
that. Wait, just a minute. There was a picture with a bat that someone had put together he reposted. Did he not?
So,
will the witness answer the question?
The witness is about to answer the question.
Did he repost it?
However ill-advised that post was, reposting that, he reposted an article.
Does that mean that you stipulate he did repost it?
Well, apparently he reposted it, but I also know he took it down when he realized what was in that photo.
Oh,
he was reposting an article, but he did take it down.
So I stabbed you in the back, but I took the knife out.
Before the knife did any damage.
That's Trump attorney Joe Tacopina with our colleague, the Reverend Al Sharpton, on the threats being made by his client, Donald Trump, against Alvin Bragg. We're back with Katie Fang, Katie Benner, Tim Miller, and Claire McCaskill. Katie Benner, this is the environment that seems to have been on the mind of DOJ as they've waded very cautiously into all of their investigations into Donald Trump and his circle over the last 2 years. Any sense of how they're dealing with actual threats against a sitting prosecutor like Alvin Bragg?
You know, I think that for the city of New York, there's heightened security around Alvin Bragg. Certainly people are really cognizant of the fact that violence could occur if Donald Trump is indicted. And I think that one of the things that we spoke about in the previous segment and, you know, sort of what we're bringing up here around violence and Alvin Bragg is what happens when people in positions of authority and power continue to, for whatever reason, say, we don't really want to address this egregious behavior by Donald Trump. So, for example, in the case of Stormy Daniels in the Manhattan prosecutor's office, saying like, but is this really the case we really want to bring against a former president? It feels so tawdry. Maybe we should wait for something more serious. We saw officials at the Justice Department from, you know, under Jeff Sessions and under Bill Barr say, do we really want to take on this behavior by Donald Trump, this incursion on, you know, our territory and our turf? Well, that just make things worse. And then suddenly you get January, you know, this discussion in January about overthrowing the department itself. And then you have January 6th breakout. So I think that what happens when people who have the authority, including Republicans, they really have probably the most power here. And they did denounce Donald Trump on January 6th, even if they walked it back. When you don't see people with influence actually push back on what Donald Trump is doing, it leaves this lane open for him to act in this way and for him to do so seemingly with impunity.
Yeah, I mean, Tim, the other way to describe it is appeasement. The Republicans have appeased criminal behavior, even while acknowledging privately and increasingly publicly that it is in many instances criminal. It has brought us to this brazen place where he launches his campaign in Waco.
Yes. Yeah, and what does appeasement lead to? Yeah, like what does appeasement lead to? More violence. That's a lesson of history. It's a lesson we've seen now. And how these guys continue to appease them after we saw the violence of January 6th, after their lives were threatened by the violence of January 6th, is something that I just really is incomprehensible. Like, I understand that they're doing it for their political survival, but it's still incomprehensible, that level of cowardice. And here we are. We're going through all of this again right now. Donald Trump is down in Waco, and we're in Groundhog Day. You know, these guys are putting their head in the sand. They're not commenting about it. They're not talking about it. They're not denouncing it. And Donald Trump is out there making imminent threats against Alvin Bragg, you know, against the others that are investigating him on his fake social media account. And he's making them at that rally in Waco, you know, talking about retribution, bleeding about death and destruction. He's saying it when Von Hilliard, who correctly confronted about this on the plane, mm-hmm. he said he wouldn't, I'm not for it, but if people are mad, people are mad. He's doing the same exact thing as Stand Back and Stand By. And yet, these guys do nothing. And so, you know what? They shouldn't be surprised when they get the same result, which is the threat and hopefully not, but a very real possibility, you know, of more violence.
I love a day when Tim Miller calls me a dog with a bone, the highest compliment ever. Katie Fang, it's a pleasure to have you at the table. Katie Benner, it's a pleasure to have you back on our airwaves. Thank you, Tim Miller and Claire McCaskill. It's always a pleasure to have you join us. Another quick break for us. We have lots more to get to. Don't go anywhere.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
We are right now awaiting an update from officials in Nashville, Tennessee, on that tragic mass shooting at an elementary school that we told you about at the top of the hour. Three students and three staffers were killed at a private school earlier today. The shooter engaged with police and was killed. She is a 28-year-old female. We'll be back on that story and much more news in the next hour of Deadline White House after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. Hi again, everybody. It's 5 o'clock in New York. It's 4 p.m. in Nashville, Tennessee. Any minute, we're expecting a news conference on that horrific, tragic shooting. It happened earlier today. Three very young children and three adults were murdered when police say a 28-year-old woman opened fire and started shooting at a school, the Covenant School. It's an elementary school. It teaches kids from preschool age through sixth grade. Police are investigating how the shooter got into the school in the first place, as well as her motive. But more importantly, the names of the victims of this latest mass shooting to take place at a school have just been released. And here are those victims. Evelyn Dykhouse, Hallie Scruggs, and William Kinney all died today. They were 9 years old. Cynthia Peake, who's 61 years old. Catherine Kuntz, who's 60 years old, and Mike Hill, who's 61 years old, also died today. The nine-year-olds, all they did was get up and go to school. Three adults likely got up and went to work. And tonight, their families are grieving this horrific loss. This afternoon, President Joe Biden, doing what has become an all too frequent ritual of the American presidency, addressing another tragedy of mass gun violence in America and calling for change.
It's just, it's sick. You know, we're still gathering the facts of what happened and why. And we do know that as of now, there are a number of people who are not going to, did not make it, including children. It's heartbreaking, a family's worst nightmare. And I want to commend the police who responded incredibly swiftly, within minutes, and the danger. We're monitoring the situation really closely, Ben, as you know. And we have to do more to stop gun violence. I call on Congress again to pass my assault weapons ban. It's about time that we begin to make some more progress.
It's where we begin the hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends, former top official in the Justice Department's National Security Division and a new MSNBC analyst. Mary McCord is here. Also joining us, Frank Figluzzi, former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence. Our friend Eddie Glaude is here. He's the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. And with us at the table, our good friend John Heilman, host and executive producer of Showtime's The Circus and executive editor of The Recount. Mary McCord, it is unbearable to read the ages of the three youngest victims today. They were nine, which means that Evelyn and Hallie and William probably got up and went to third grade today, and they were shot and killed in America's latest mass shooting. What can we do at this point to stop this?
I mean, the numbers are just staggering. One of the unique things about this shooting is the shooter was a female. And according to the Violence Project, only four of over 170 mass shooters since 1966 have been women. But the mass shootings just keep escalating. You know, from our first double-digit mass shooting, and happily this one is not a double-digit mass shooting, but if the shooter hadn't been killed, it very well might have been if the police hadn't gotten there as quickly as they did. Until 1949, we didn't have any double-digit mass shootings. Then for almost four decades, we only had four. In 21-22, we had 2 years alone, four double-digit mass shootings. And if you count all mass shootings, four or more people killed or injured, not including the shooter, we had about two a day, resulting in 1,200 deaths. And not insignificant number of those deaths have been children in schools. Yet no matter what we do, there seems to be that the assault-style rifles that are used in the majority of these shootings, high-capacity magazines used in almost every single one of these shootings, no matter what we do, these remain popular, they remain on the market, and the manufacturers still face no liability. So, you know, we are failing in trying to prevent this type of gun violence, including for our most vulnerable victims, like the children who were killed today.
And Frank, it's not just that we don't do anything. There are at least three Republican members of Congress who celebrate these weapons Mary's talking about, who wear AR-15 style pins on their lapels. We have something more than inaction. It's not a gridlock problem. It's an enthusiasm for the gun culture on the right.
You're right. It's worse than doing nothing. It's worse than being neutral on the issue. They actually fight to see these things happen. That's the bottom line. And look, you know, states have tried individually to do the right thing, but until we have a national law that impacts the ability to access assault style weapons, we're not going to get our hands around this problem, because the weakest link in the picture is the nearest state that allows you to purchase this. And don't be surprised if this 28-year-old woman was lawfully in possession of these two assault style rifles and the handgun. We don't know yet, but wouldn't surprise me at all if she did the right thing, went through the background check. So The problem is no longer, hey, we need to enforce the rules in place. Yes, we do. Of course. Right. And we try to do that with an ATF that is woefully understaffed. It is ludicrous to think that something like 3,000 special agents are going to cover the nation when we have more guns than people and they're going to enforce existing law. But we're beyond enforcing existing law. We need change and we need it now. And we need people to vote for that change. And as Mary said, we need accountability for manufacturers. It needs to hurt them. We need to bring pain to the people who produce the weapons of mass destruction. And now, yes, is it an interesting statistic amongst this awful, tragic human toll to say, boy, we have a female shooter? Yes, it's noteworthy for those of us who study and research this, that in the last 40 years, we've had somewhere like 3, 4, or 5 female shooters, depending on how you define a mass shooting. By the definition of 4 or more dead people, we've had only 3 female shooters in the last 40 years or so. So what does it mean? It means that this now has penetrated gender. This is bigger than gender. We have to stop saying this is entirely a male problem or toxic masculinity or what have you. This is a societal problem. And now the latest report I've seen from NBC is that the police are saying this woman was previously a student at this elementary school. Wow. So we could talk for an hour about grievances and baggage and carrying elementary school baggage to your 28. We don't know what this is going to play out to, but that goes toward mental health and warning signs and indicators. And yes, my last thought on this for the moment, we're on TV now, and I've been on earlier with NBC and Lester Holt saying, yeah, we do acknowledge and laud the police department who gets it right and engages and goes in. Absolutely, they are heroes, and there would have been more death. But I'm tired of getting on television and saying, thank God there weren't more dead people. Boy, it's only X number of victims. That's horrible for us to be the assessor of that in that manner. We need to go on TV and say there need be no more victims in America of gun violence.
Because, Eddie, the lives and the parents of Evelyn Dykhouse, who was 9, and Hallie Scruggs, who was 9, and William Kinney, who was 9, their lives are over. Over. Changed forever, at a minimum. Cynthia Peake's family, Catherine Kuntz's family, and Mike Hill's family, ages 61, 60, and 61, those families, those universes shattered forever, long after we're starting our broadcast with the story of today's deadly mass shooting at a school.
Yeah, every breath they take from now on will be smothered in grief, you know? I've been trying to figure this out, and, you know, because everything sounds so damn familiar. You know, and you know, I think everything Frank said is right. Everything Mary said is right. But, you know, I think something about us is broken and we won't acknowledge it. It's not just simply about the guns. It's about us. The guns, of course, make it worse, but we're broken. And it's not just simply those who have AR-15s on their lapels, Nicole. It's the fact that we don't fight like hell against them. You know, it's like we 3 babies. I couldn't imagine Langston at 9 not coming home from school. I couldn't imagine that. And the fact that we don't fight like hell. Me, you, we go through this and then we say what we say and then we go back to our lives and they have to breathe grief every day again. It's like we're not fighting for the kind of world we want. And these monsters who are so selfish around their guns, right, continue to allow for the condition that will take a Hallie, a William, take these 3 babies away from us. That, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to process it. It goes beyond just simply the guns. It goes to us. We're broken. Because it keeps happening over and over again.
I don't know what else to say other than what Eddie just articulated. I mean, because the statistics, as Mary and Frank detailed them, are right in front of our face. And they're in front of our face before we come to work, and switch everything that we're going to talk about. You know, you weren't booked to talk about the latest school shooting and 3 9-year-olds who lost their lives because they went to third grade today. But here we are.
Yeah. I have literally no wisdom on this topic. I feel like, like everybody else, this happens all the time. You have to be ready to talk about a school shooting if you're ever going to be on television, because it could happen pretty much any moment. I don't have any wisdom about it. I think, I was at Waco this weekend. We're going to talk about that a little later. But, there are a lot of things. If you walk around in the area where they're selling the merch, the right wing merch there, there are a lot of things that are disturbing. Among the many things that are disturbing about things in that culture, one of them is that the thing you talked about earlier, which is the celebration of guns, so many T-shirts that say things like not vaccinated and then a picture of an AR-15. Fully protected, just everywhere, man. It's just like there's so many of the celebratory things. I had a kid. I couldn't say what his age was, but he was not 18. We didn't put him on camera because he was too young. He might have been 11, who wanted to show me his T-shirt. And he had a whole long screed on the back of the T-shirt, printed T-shirt, a thing that was sold in mass quantities that was about protecting the Second Amendment and how essentially it was a long political screed that basically said, if we don't all have our guns, America won't be America anymore. He was about 12 and he was very proud. He wanted me to read it. Look at the back of my T-shirt, Wow. I don't blame that kid, but there's a culture out there. And obviously we know the story of what happened at Waco. How did Waco start? Waco started because David Koresh was building machine guns out of AR-15s, taking semi-automatic weapons, making them machine guns. And it was when the ATF saw evidence of that and the fact that David Koresh was raping young girls that they decided to try to make a move on Waco. And that's what started the whole 51-day siege. And those people are heroes now on the right. All right. David Koresh and the Waco, the Branch Davidians are now, we'll talk about this more later, but that's how deep it goes. And it's not new. The only other thing I'll say is I agree. Some parts of the culture are obviously broken. And it's not all about policy, but I always come back to this thing. We live on this global community here in 2023, and there's no other country in the world that has this problem. America is unique, but are we really ready to say America is broken and France, Germany, England, China, India, name your country, just stick in the industrialized Western Europe. That like Sweden, Denmark, Belgium, all of those people, they're not broken. We're the broken ones. They're not broken. I think there are unique characteristics to American culture, but it's also they have sane gun laws. We do not. And if you want to try to explain why they don't have mass shootings in those places, you have to point to policy.
There's no other difference.
There are some other differences. There are differences between us and the Belgians, but not like so fundamental that right. America is broken and Belgium is not. I'm not ready to accept that. I think the difference is that the policies are whack here and they are sane in those other places.
Well, it's the indifference. It's the indifference to, we come on the news and announce the names of 3 9-year-olds who lost their lives today at school. At bleeping school.
And the policies don't change.
Correct. We are right now waiting for an update from local officials in Nashville, Tennessee. They're about to start a news conference. Those are the microphones on the left side of your screen. If we really interrupt any of our guests, it's because it started and we don't want to miss it. But right now, joining our conversation, Texas State Senator Ronald Gutierrez. He's been advocating for a lot of what we're talking about, gun safety legislation to stop what has become tragically a new normal, the prevalence of mass shootings at schools. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you.
What goes through your mind when you see, I think we all hear of this in a similar way. Most of us get to our phones before we get to our TVs these days. You're never prepared for the dread and the gut punch, whether you have kids or not, of seeing that an elementary school has been targeted.
Yeah, as you know, I represent the Uvalde area in Texas. First thing that I did this morning when I heard of the news is I texted a group of families that I'm very close to, and I asked them if they were okay. And I called a couple of them, and they're not okay. And they are immediately, the first thing that they could think of was, we're going to try to get to Tennessee so that we can try to talk to these families that just lost their children, so that we can walk them through this pain.
Senator,
I don't think that you can ever get... Yes, ma'am.
Can you stay with us and talk us out of this news conference that's just beginning?
Worst day. But let us love each other
and support each other and hug each other and pray for each other and pray for our families. But also let us praise our first responders. 14 minutes, I believe, under fire, running to gunfire. And then I want to thank the seamless response for federal and state authorities from our police and fire department. So this morning, I was in Boston to see my own son's sporting event, and now I am overwhelmed at the thought of the loss of these families, of the future lost by these children and their families. And the leading cause of kids get death now is guns and gunfire. And that is unacceptable. But I want to thank the fast response of our officers. Guns are quick. They don't give you much time. So even in a remarkably fast response, there was not enough time. And those guns stole precious lives from us today in Nashville. And in this dark hour, let us support each other. Let us go and hug our children a little bit closer tonight. And thank you all for being here. And I want to ask Chief Drake to come and give us an update.
Thank you, Mayor Cooper. Again, thank you all for being here. Just an update from today's press conference. We've identified the shooter as Audrey Hale, a 28-year-old female that lived in the Nashville area. We have investigations ongoing now at the residence on Brightwood Avenue. And we have made contact with the father that lived at that residence and are putting together more information. We've also determined there were maps drawn of the school in detail of surveillance, entry points, etc. We know and believe that entry was gained through shooting through one of the doors is how they actually got into the school. I want to take the time to at least say, and I won't say the victims' names, I'll let Don say that, but out of the six victims, three adults, three of those were children. Two of them were age 9. One was 8, about to be 9. All the families have been contacted. The victims' families have been contacted as well. My thoughts and prayers go out to the family. When we send our kids to school or to any place of safety, we expect them to live, learn, have fun, and come back from that day's experience. We don't anticipate things like this. And I want to say thank you to our partners, to Chief Swan, to Glenn Funk, to our mayor for his support, to our federal partners. But also I want to say thank you to our first responders who got there and immediately went in and addressed the threat of someone that had multiple rounds of ammunition, prepared for a confrontation with law enforcement, prepared to do more harm than was actually done, and we were able to stop the threat and unfortunately 6 victims. So my thoughts and prayers again, but the praise go to the men and women. As I've said before, we will not wait. I was hoping this day would never ever come here in this city, but we would never wait to make entry and to go in and to stop a threat, especially when it deals with our children. So thank you. They're not. Just me. They're not saying anything.
I'm going to go over the victims' names with you now. The 3 9-year-olds who were killed, Evelyn Dickhouse, William Kenny, Hallie Scruggs. 3 adults, Mike Hill, a custodian, age 61,
Cynthia Peek, to my understanding, a substitute teacher, age 61, and Catherine Kuntz, age 60. As Chief Drake said, we have identified the active shooter as Audrey Elizabeth Hale, age 28. We'll take just a few questions if you have any.
Don, do we believe that she was a former student at the school?
Yes, we do. Chief, you want to address that?
Yes, from our investigations tell us that she was a former student at the school. I don't know what grade she's attended or grades, but we do firmly believe she was a student there.
Does she identify as transgender?
She does identify as transgender, yes.
Is there any reason to believe the shooter first went to the church before going to the school?
I can't give you that information, Alonzo. We know that the minute the calls came in, we responded to the church, so to the school.
To the school.
Yeah.
Did you have, like, was there, like, two officers that went in when they first got there? Do you know how many there was when they first entered?
So it was five officers that immediately went in and addressed. We have video that we're going to release, but you can see in the video, you can hear gunfire going on as they're in the school. They address the threat and take that threat down.
And Chief, what do we know about her weapons?
So we know there were two AR-style weapons, one a rifle, another was an AR-style pistol, and the other was a handgun. We believe two of those may have been obtained legally, locally here.
Can you confirm that one of the adult victims, Catherine Kuntz, was head of the school?
Was what?
Was head of the school?
There was some, I don't know her exact capacity within the school, but it was higher up in the echelon.
And were any of the children victims related to any of the school staff?
Unsure. I believe one may have been, but I can't confirm that.
Did the shooter have any criminal history?
No history at all.
And no motive at this point? Anything discovered in the apartment or house?
No, we have a manifesto. We have some writings that we're going over that pertain to this date, the actual incident. We have a map drawn out of how this was all going to take place. There's right now a theory of that we may be able to talk about later, but it's not confirmed. And so we'll put that out as soon as we can.
And Chief, is there any reason to believe that how she identifies a white?
I'm sorry, I knocked someone's mic over. I didn't hear you say that again, sir.
Is there any reason to believe that how she identifies has any motive for targeting the school?
We can give you that at a later time. There is some theory to that. We're investigating all the leads, and once we know exactly, we'll let you know.
So was this a targeted attack?
It was.
Do we know about a history of mental illness? Man or woman?
Don't know any history of mental illness at this time, but we are looking at that as the investigation is ongoing. And I'm sorry.
Does she identify as a transgender man or woman?
It's a woman.
Was this the only school that was targeted?
It was the only school that was targeted. There was another location that was mentioned, but because of a threat assessment by the suspect, too much security, they decided not to. And that area was here in Nashville, so we're continuing with that investigation as well. Right now, we believe it's a lone assailant, and we don't anticipate any further damage at this time, but we're still investigating.
The Brightwood address, she lived there with her parents? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
So the scene is going to be processed throughout the night, probably into tomorrow. This is an extensive scene. As you know, she entered the building, which is one structure. The church and the school are in one building. She entered on the lower floor. There were shots fired on the lower floor before she went to the upper level. And it was on the upper level where she was confronted by police and killed. So understand the scene processing will take place over at least 2 days, today and tomorrow. And we'll have more details for you, including the release of video, perhaps tonight, but if not tonight, certainly tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Roland Gutierrez, we cut you off before we were going into this. Some new information I just want to recap before I turn the floor back over to you. We learned that this was a 14-minute exchange maybe not gunfire, but confrontation with the shooter. Five officers were involved. The shooter possessed two AR-style weapons and a handgun. At least some of those weapons were obtained legally. The officer there says that the shooter is trans and identifies as a woman. They also describe some of what they understood to be the planning for today's attack, describing the school as being, quote, targeted. And the mass shooting was a, quote, targeted attack. Maps were drawn of the school and the plan of attack. They also shared with the press there that there was a manifesto and other writings. There was a commitment to releasing some video of the shooting through of one of the doors, shooting out one of the doors. The law enforcement officials also talking about some unconfirmed theories. There's a discrepancy as well on the ages. Two of the young victims were nine. One of the young victims was eight, just shy of a ninth birthday. So, Senator Gutierrez, the details seem to make it more tragic, more horrific, more real than even before, if that's possible.
It's unreal that we're doing this yet again, Nicole. We do this, it seems, almost every week in our nation. We're certainly a broken nation, but I think that what's broken is Republican leaders in Congress, in Washington, at every state legislature. Tennessee, like Texas, doesn't have extreme risk protective orders, doesn't have background check legislation, doesn't have age limit restrictions. An 18-year-old, it wasn't the case today in Tennessee, but an 18-year-old could buy a weapon like this and commit all sorts of horrific acts. We've got to do something in our nation. There is one common denominator. There is mental health problems all over this country, all over the world, as one of your previous speakers suggested, but we have no gun laws. It's not to say that we have weak gun laws. Our gun laws are so weak that a 12-year-old has a t-shirt that says, I deserve to have my weapons of mass destruction. I deserve to have my AR-15s. We have a giant problem in this country. And from here on out, people are going to have to think about every day that they send their little kids to school, that this may be the last time, because politicians in Washington and in every legislature refuse to do anything. Eric Swalwell said it best. Republicans choose the killers over the kids. They choose guns over the kids. We've got to do something.
Senator, what are the Uvalde families saying to you today? I always think that this is something that never abates for a mom or dad or any parent. Even if your kids survive something that terrifying, that the terror is forever. And I wonder, you know, how tied they feel to this tragic loss in another American city today.
They're the strongest people I've ever met in my life. I don't know that I could ever come to Austin or go to Washington and advocate for change as much as they have been advocating for change. Yet they keep coming. They don't want this to happen to another family. And yet here we are again, and they have to relive all of their trauma and all of the tragedy. You know, Emmett Till's mother was right when she wanted to see the world what the Deep South had done to her little boy. I have seen hours and hours of video cam footage, and I've seen what that gun can do to a little baby, to a 9 and a 10-year-old and an 11-year-old. America needs to wake up on this. We need common sense gun safety. We need, at the federal level, we need an assault weapons ban. I mean, it's time. These things did not happen when we had the assault weapons ban. They just didn't, not to this pace. We sell 600,000 AR-15s in the United States every year. 68% of them, by the way, end up going to Mexico, the majority through Texas. We've got real problems, and we've got to address this issue. And if we don't,
more and more little babies are going to die. I am pleading with every Republican in the legislature here in Texas, as I am all over this country, to open your eyes and do something here. Open your eyes.
A lot of people felt that if after Newtown things didn't change, that they might never change. Others see flashes of hope in the fact that some Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, came around and did something more than nothing for the first time in 30 years. People like Fred Guttenberg, who lost his daughter, Jamie, in the Parkland shooting, sees this president as someone committed to doing more, but obviously he can't act alone. Where do you put your, do you permit yourself to feel optimistic that, policies can change at the federal level?
Well, I've been very honest with my Uvalde families and told them not to expect much out of a Republican-controlled Texas legislature. At least for the first time under Joe Biden, we saw historic gun safety legislation in the Safer Communities Act. But we have a long way to go. Federal Congress, for instance, can establish an age limit of 21 to have an assault rifle. Quite frankly, it ought to be 25. We ought to not have them at all. But we have to have our federal legislatures begin to look at those issues. To look at extreme risk protective orders, just the gun show loophole in many states, like in Texas, is so dangerous that we need to close that loophole. You can go into a gun show in Texas, show your ID, and that's it. You get a question whether you're a U.S. citizen or a U.S. resident, and have you ever been convicted of a felony? In other words, if you're not buying from a federally licensed dealer, you walk out with an AR-15 without so much as a single background check, without so much as a single call to anybody. The ATF isn't even part of that formula. We have to do things that make sense in this space. We can still have the Second Amendment protections and still regulate guns. We're allowed to do that, and we can do that, and we should.
Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez, who represents the Uvalde families, thank you very much for spending time with us today. I imagine it's a difficult story and a difficult conversation, but we are grateful.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much.
Frank, I'm coming back to you on some of the new information we learned from this briefing. Officials there, very forthcoming. We learned that the altercation, the incident, took 14 minutes. Five officers were involved. The shooter had two assault-style weapons and one handgun. Some of those weapons were obtained legally. Maps were drawn of the school and a plan of attack. He also mentioned some manifestos and writings and other things that we would be gaining access to soon. Very, very forthcoming in terms of what they know now and what they know but aren't quite yet ready to release.
Right. So we had just discussed, you and I, right prior to the press conference, don't be surprised if we find out that these weapons were legally purchased. And the spokesperson said at least two of them were lawfully purchased. What does that tell us? It's not so much an enforcement problem we're dealing with. She may have complied perfectly with the laws, but rather it's a gun problem. It's a gun problem, as State Senator Gutierrez said. We've got to get our hands around this. And if it's incremental change and we're taking baby steps, understand while we're taking baby steps, babies will be killed like they were today in Nashville. Yes, from a law enforcement perspective, fantastic. We have a manifesto. She'll explain everything she was thinking. It may not make sense to a lot of people. Likely not. We have premeditation and cold blood. We have planning. We've got the allegedly sketches or maps of their schematics of the school, and she shot. We know now that she shot her way through a door or into a door. So we've already answered a question. Was she allowed in? Was a door unlocked or open? No, apparently, if I heard correctly, she shot her way through that door. This is planning. This is planning. And boy, if she attended that school and it's an elementary school, let's assume she was eight. She's 28 now. 20 years of this, and it involved innocence. 2 9-year-olds and an 8-year-old who had nothing to do with whatever grudge she had 20 years ago at that school.
So So, Eddie, I'm back to you and where you started, that we are broken. An 8-year-old and 2 9-year-olds likely weren't even alive when the shooter attended the school. But they lost. They were murdered today, along with three, or at least one janitor and two educators or administrators at the school. And long after we're done talking about Nashville, because we've moved on to somewhere else, Buffalo or Uvalde or Parkland or Newtown or Montgomery Park, or whoever has the misfortune of coming next, these families will still be broken. They will have still stopped time today. This will be the beginning of something totally different that they've never known before.
Yeah, and they join the company of a whole host of other families as well, right? I was just thinking about the shooter, the killer, thinking about how clinging to hate, we cling to it because we don't want to deal with our pain, and it can make us monstrous. I'm also thinking about what John said, and I think our brokenness explains our policy failures. And I got three things that come to mind, Nicole. Greed, unbridled greed that overruns any notion of the public good, gun manufacturers. I'm thinking about selfishness. Don't take away my guns, even though these families are losing their babies, even though people are being shot with bump stocks and weapons of war, I still have the right to my gun. To be damned, you're dead. Selfishness, selfishness. The second. The third, indifference. Well, it's not my baby. I'm safe where I am. And so when you combine greed, selfishness, and indifference, democracy cannot survive. We're broken. And so we have to address the cultural background as we address the policy issue. We got to get the guns under control, but we also got to get the fact that we are not committed to a notion of the public good. And why is that the case? Why is that the case? I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it.
No, me too. And it's the third one that scares me the most. Indifference. I can talk to someone who disagrees with me passionately, but the blankness of indifference, I think, is what endangers all of us. All right. I need all of you to stick around. I need all of you for the next conversation. When we come back, we're going to shift gears. John Heilman actually brought us here already a little bit. We're, of course, going to talk about and share with you what and where the twice impeached, disgraced ex-president was over the weekend, now in a full embrace of the most dangerous, most violent elements of right-wing extremism, not just right now in America, but in America's history. We'll tell you about it with our experts and friends next.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Trump said, if he's indicted, he said, quote, death and destruction will follow. Can you imagine there'll be death and destruction in the wake of Trump getting indicted?
No, I think that's hyperbole.
Not from our side.
Potential death and destruction would be in terms of his political career. That's the way I interpret it.
Okay. Now, some people look at that picture and they think that that's Donald Trump threatening violence against a public official. When you see that picture, what do you think?
I think he sure has a sense of humor.
Huh. We're back with Mary McCord, Frank Figluzzi, Eddie Glaude, and John Heilman, all, lucky for us, MSNBC contributors. So you went to Waco.
Those are the least alarming ones. The woman who talked about how she thought Trump was great to attack Alvin Bragg as a Soros-backed animal because George Soros is a Jew. That was the one that struck me as most, jumped out at me the most. You know, it's also the case that all of them, basically, here's the consensus. One, the indictment is BS. You know, he should be able to have sex with porn stars and whatever. And they all are on the impression that the statute of limitations has run out and there's no case. That's number one. Number two, they all say peaceful protests. We're all for peaceful protests. But when you ask them about concerns because of January 6th, they all say, well, we weren't part, like, Trump supporters were part of that. They are all still really on. That was Antifa and BLM. That whole thing was a false. That everything bad that happened at the Capitol has nothing to do with us. We MAGA people would never do that. That's all because the left wing instigators, the infiltrators got in.
How do they explain Stuart Rhodes and Enrique Tarrio and those guys being there?
I think you might assume that they have more detailed knowledge about some of these things. It's not like they're just on the talking points, which are like, we are peaceful. We will protest for Trump. We will protest peacefully. This is BS. It's all political. Oh, also, Bill Clinton never got arrested. I heard that a lot down there, too. You know, the thing about this rally, it was a very, at the end of a week where Trump, particularly when he announced that they were doing this at Waco, because of some of the history we talked about before, we'll talk about it more. It was disturbing that they were having it at Waco. And does Donald Trump, how much does he know the history of Waco? I don't know. But Roger Stone, we were talking about this off air, dedicated a book to the Branch Davidians. You know, a lot of people around, guys like Steve Bannon, they know the history of Waco and they know how totemic it is on the right, on the anti-government right. They knew what the message they were sending. It's like when Ronald Reagan started his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights leaders had been slain in the 60s and said, I'm for states' rights. You're sending, you know, there are accidents in politics, but not coincidences. And when you go into a thing like this, you are sending a message, and it was even more pointed in the context of the week that we'd seen, where he was launched this public campaign of intimidation, racist, anti-Semitic campaign of intimidation against Bragg and the grand jurors. So we got there and you saw two things that were really striking. One, not gotten enough attention, was Trump in his speech when he stood up and said, people ask me what the biggest threat to America is. And they say, is it Russia, sir? Is it China, sir? And I say, no. It's people in the United States government. It's Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, the Department of Justice, and their henchmen in the DA's offices and the attorney general's. That was like a very straight up kind of like, you know, and then he puts it in apocalyptic terms. They are destroying America. They are the risk. Not Putin, not China, none of that. These American government officials, including Mitch McConnell and my party, they need to go. And this, in this apocalyptic blast battle thing of 2024 is the final battle. It's this very David Koreshian final battle. Like the language is very apocalyptic. The other thing was him standing up and doing the J6 choir, you know, which is the song that's now a phenomenon on the right of the political prisoners, as they call them, the insurrectionists who are in jail. And Trump standing up to his hand over his heart, listening to these prisoners, these insurrectionists sing the national anthem. And of course, that song includes him doing the stat that he lent his voice to him doing the Pledge of Allegiance, which is really the most overt effort on Trump's part to say, not like January 6th isn't as bad as you think. January 6th was a glorious day in American history. These are patriots. They were doing the right thing. They were peaceful. You've been lied to. He is embracing, in that song, number one on iTunes, as he points out, he's embracing the counter narrative full on. And we could talk about the roots of that in Waco and all the other stuff, but it's like, he's pro-insurrectionist now. He's right out there saying it right there on stage playing that song. That was a very chilling moment.
Well, let's not disaggregate this. Let's do that right now. I mean, I wasn't aware until I really read in on Waco that Roger Stone, his closest political mind, dedicated his book, Smearing the Clintons, to the Branch Davidians. Alex Jones, one of the co-conspirators of the insurrection, rose to infamy in the ashes of Waco. I mean, just talk about Trump's orbits, ties to Waco.
You know, Alex Jones was a nobody on Austin radio before Waco happened. You know, when Waco happened, the story that people know, I think, is Timothy McVeigh was there on the side of the road passing out anti-government literature
during
the standoff between the FBI and the Branch Davidians. As people probably know, David Koresh and those Branch Davidians, when the FBI finally tried to break in after 51 days, they lit their own compound on fire. 82 in the end, I think it was 82 total. I think 75, 76 died that day. 25 or so children in a self-imposed fire that they set off. I will tell you, the right will tell you that they didn't set those fires off. That was the FBI set that on fire. Although there's compelling evidence to claim the contrary. Out of that, Timothy McVeigh walked 2 years later on the anniversary. 2 years later, April 19th, 1995, blows up the Alfred P. Murrah building, 100 whatever it was, people killed in that. And he said, when he was asked why he did what he did, he said, Waco started this war. And that became, for the Patriot movement, for the Michigan militia back in the 90s, now for the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, they all say this, that Waco is the the Ruby Ridge was the kind of the prologue. Waco was the moment that the Patriots all realized that American government was tyrannical and was turning its force against them, and they needed to do something about it. And if you want to think about the birth of everything we've seen in the alt-right, far-right, you know, the stuff that led to the insurrection on January 6th, it all goes back to Waco in some sense. And it really is in Donald Trump's world, that part of Donald Trump's world. Everybody knows that history, and that word Waco is not tragic. It's a word. It's a spark. It's a totemic kind of like turning point for like, this is when we got the clarity that we needed, that the government is the enemy.
Mary McCord, we waste too much time wondering if Donald Trump, because he seems like such a moron, knows any of this. It's irrelevant because the domestic terrorists know all of this history. So I'm going to skip past that question and ask you if the FBI, and we have to mention Merrick Garland, of course, who prosecuted Timothy McVeigh and Oklahoma City. I mean, is the FBI at the National Security Division level on a footing to protect the country from whatever is being stirred up in the DVE space?
Well, I think it's a real challenge because they certainly know of many of the threats. I think that sometimes their own internal policies blind them somewhat to actually recognizing and intaking all of the information that is out there, including information that is collected by private researchers showing trends toward extremism. You know, the FBI, for some good reasons, you know, really strongly the pendulum swung post COINTELPRO in terms of their concern about doing anything that they could be criticized for infringing on First Amendment rights. And I think sometimes they've taken that so far that they actually sort of willfully blind themselves from taking in the information that they need to be able to prepare for some of the threats. But even assuming perfect information that they're able to get through their own sources and through those who willingly provide it to them, we have lone actors who will always be difficult to prevent. And, you know, that's particularly the case when you have all the things we've been talking about today. We have a proliferation of guns in this country. They're too easy to come by. And we have a narrative that is actually hijacking patriotism, the flag, the Star Spangled Banner as a song, hijacking that by extremists who would then cloak themselves in constitutional rights. And, you know, they're wrong about so many of the constitutional principles that they hang their hat on. We talked in the earlier segment about the Second Amendment. Now, the Supreme Court has recently ruled in a major ruling about the Second Amendment, but nothing the Supreme Court said in the Bruin case decided last June suggested that you have a right to get an AR-15 assault-style rifle or any other kind of gun and go kill people with it. It was about self-defense. The Supreme Court has said over and over and over again that Second Amendment right for individuals to bear arms is about self-defense. It's not about and you don't need assault-style rifles or high-capacity magazines for self-defense. Yet this idea of rights, patriotism, all of this is really, you know, we're really pitting rights against rights because people have a right to send their children to school without fear of violence. People have a right to engage in their own First Amendment protected activity, their own freedom of association, their own petitioning of their governments without fear of violence. So these are all things that are going on out there as the FBI is trying to protect public safety. And it's a big challenge. And, you know, it's a big agency and they're trying their best, but I think it's very difficult to do.
So, Frank, I don't work at the FBI, but if I did, these aren't dots on some Trump derangement syndrome sort of delusion, but there's a direct line in black and white. Roger Stone dedicates his book in ink to the Branch Davidians. The Branch Davidians are viewed as martyrs by declared groups who celebrate them in black and white, in ink, or online, the three percenters and the right-wing militias. The right-wing militias proudly organized their participation of their members in the January 6th insurrection. Donald Trump rolls footage of January 6th, puts his hand over his heart, and pays tribute to them, redefining patriotism in America with a direct line, again, not a conspiracy theory, in black and white, from Stone to the Branch Davidians, to the militia groups, to the insurrection, to the likely Republican nominee for president in 2024. What do you think is happening inside the FBI to protect us from that direct line?
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Wow. Yeah, I've had the same thought myself. First, let me dispel any notion that anything significantly changed in terms of how the FBI can operate post January 6th. I think many people, if you ask them, hey, you think things have gotten better in terms of addressing domestic terrorism after January 6th? You think people changed the rules? There's no evidence of that whatsoever. We still have no domestic terrorism law. And I don't believe, unless there was a secret memo from DOJ, I don't believe the guidelines, the operational guidelines for the FBI have changed one iota with regard to the domestic terrorism program. And recall, after 9/11, an international terrorism attack, we created an entire institution called the Department of Homeland Security, and we passed the Patriot Act and laws regarding supporting international terrorism. So They have a tough job. Yes, they're aware. I know they're aware. They're watching. They're monitoring. And boy, do I hope that Special Counsel Jack Smith pressed record this weekend, Saturday night, for the Waco rally. Because I hope he tries to introduce into evidence. I don't know if he'll succeed, but I hope he tries to introduce into evidence former President Trump playing footage of January 6th. At his rally. And I hope he gets into evidence statements like death and destruction with regard to the case. I hope he gets into evidence the picture of Trump about to swing a baseball bat at Alvin Bragg's head. I hope all of that gets into evidence for mindset and context, because that's what Trump is doing. And I am pleased that John Heilman has drawn that line for us that many people are unaware of what happened at Waco, and the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building 2 years later by a guy named Timothy McVeigh, who was simply there at Waco observing what happened and tried to get retribution when he blew up the federal building with a daycare center in it. So one has to ask, with regard to what's the FBI thinking about right now, one question is, who was at Waco Saturday night in the crowd? Who's the next Timothy McVeigh that's going to act on the rhetoric and the incitement of violence of Donald Trump and do something horrible next week, next year, or 2 years from now?
It's March 27th. April 19th is the 30th anniversary of Waco. This whole period, the 51 days, is considered. That's another thing. It doesn't just go into Waco, as that Trump did this event in the middle of the anniversary of the siege. April 19th's coming. And if I'm at the FBI, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm worried about April 19th. I'm worried about the 30th anniversary.
We will, for our part, with all of your help, continue to stay on this. But, you know, the truth can't ever be sugarcoated. Donald Trump and the people around him know exactly where they were and what they were doing and who was there and who had walked there before them. Frank Figluzzi, Eddie Glaude, John Heilman, and Mary McCord, thank you so much. We want to let you know that Mary is the co-host, along with our friend Andrew Weissman, of our new podcast series, Prosecuting Donald Trump. Don't miss out on that. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Even if the news is difficult, it's great to be back. And I thank you for letting us into your homes for another day of breaking news.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.